Another episode of Flight Tales.
Who?
Peyton,
best I can do.
Okay, that's good. That's good enough. Peyton Enloe, local DPE here. Well, I know you were in Vietnam, but before that, I don't know. I think you had told me one time you got into flying before you had to go to Vietnam.
That's true. I was interested in airplanes pretty much from day one as a little boy. Built control line models and always bugging my parents to take me to the airport to watch airplanes take off and land. But I didn't really start flying until I was my 20th birthday.
Okay.
I was living in San Antonio, going to college there, graduated from high school there, and I was driving by the airport one day, and there was a Discovery flight for $5.
Oh, it's not that price anymore.
And I had $5 in my pocket, so I went in and took the Discovery flight, and from that point on, I was full speed ahead to become a professional pilot.
Oh, okay. So where are you originally from?
Born in Springfield, Missouri.
Okay.
My father was in the hotel business when I was growing up, so every time he got a chance to move to a bigger property, we would move.
Oh, okay.
In my younger days, we moved around quite a bit, but ended up in San Antonio. Once I got hooked on flying, my goal was to, at the time, United Airlines was hiring private pilots. If you were a private pilot with a college degree, they would hire you and train you to get your instrument rating in commercial and then put you to work as a flight engineer on a 727.
Wow.
So it was actually possible to get hired as a private pilot in those days.
Wow, the times have changed.
Yeah, they have. But you had to. So that's why I was going to college. I wanted to finish up, go ahead and get my training done and do that. But
did you ever go that route?
I did not.
Okay.
I did not. I went full speed ahead, started my training. I was pretty much flying 5 days a week trying to get my ratings.
Yeah.
And in those days, if you did not have some kind of a deferment, you were going to get drafted.
Like going to college? Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
I had an educational deferment. You had to be taking 12 hours and making at least a 2.5 grade point average in order to have the educational deferment. I was more interested in flying than I was going to business administration at college. So I dropped a course that I was about to fail and put me under 12 hours, thinking I could get away with it for one semester.
Yeah.
But 3 months after I dropped the course, I got the letter.
Oh.
Uncle Sam wants you.
Yeah, they said. Man.
Which is a huge bend in the road.
Yes, I bet. So you didn't finish your private?
Well, I did.
Oh, you did?
Okay. By that time, I was a flight instructor in airplanes.
Okay.
I had my instrument instructor rating. I was working at the flight school where I learned to fly. The day I got my draft notice, I went down. I didn't have my degree yet, so I couldn't get into the Air Force or the Navy. But the Army was taking high school graduates.
Oh, okay.
So I took my letter down to the Army recruiter and said, any chance I can fly for you guys? He said, maybe. We're going to have to jump through some hoops, but let's start jumping.
Okay.
So I was able to get all the testing done and the interviews that were required, and I got an Army flight school slot before I had to report for basic training.
Well, that's helicopters.
Yeah, this was in 1968.
Okay.
August the 8th, 1968, I reported to the induction center in San Antonio, and they put me on a DC-3 to Fort Polk.
Oh, okay.
And I went through basic training at Fort Polk.
Okay. Wow, that's not too far down the road.
No, it's not. In fact, almost all of the Army warrant officer helicopter pilots went through basic training at Fort Polk.
Okay.
Once you finished basic training, they shipped you off to Mineral Wells, Texas for the beginning of your flight training. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And you did the first 110 hours of training there at Fort Walters, all your you soloed and your basic helicopter skills. Took about 6 months to get all that done. And then at that point, they shipped you off to Fort Rucker, Alabama, where you finished. And everybody got checked out in the Huey, and they taught you how to fly formation and go in and out of tight areas in formation and things like that.
So you probably flew right through that because you had already had all your ratings.
Being a flight instructor prior to going into the Army was a huge advantage going through flight school. It enabled me to graduate in the top of my class, which got me a Chinook slot.
Okay.
In other words, I went straight from flight school to Chinook school, checked out in the Chinook, and then went to Vietnam as a Chinook pilot. Yeah, it's a tandem rotor, twin-engine helicopter.
It's a transport? Is that?
Yeah, I mean, it holds 33 people.
Okay.
33 fully loaded, fully armed troops.
Yeah.
But primarily, we carried sling loads. We would hover over 155 millimeter cannon, as an example, and pick it up and take it out to a fire base. A fire base was a hill that had been cleared off, and they had typically five or six artillery pieces out there. And the only way you could get there in many cases was by helicopter. There was no road. It was kind of out back in the mountainous area. They would position these fire bases so they had overlapping coverage. In other words, they could put an artillery round anywhere that they wanted it with this overlapping coverage. But all these fire bases had to be supplied by helicopter. And that means fuel,
everything,
ammunition,
yeah.
people,
yeah.
everything yeah. went by helicopter. So that's really what we did primarily, was resupply those fire bases.
You being top of your class, you were able to pick what helicopter you wanted, right? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and at the time, the two main choices were either the Cobra or the Chinook, just depending on whether you wanted to fly gunships or transport.
How long were you there for?
The Vietnam tour was a year. They had a program in place when I was there, where if you volunteered to stay an additional 6 months in Vietnam, you got out of the Army early.
Okay.
And which is what I did.
You stayed another 6 months?
Yes.
So you can go
I was
back
having
to-
fun.
Oh, you were having fun?
Yeah, I liked it.
Oh, okay.
It was fun. I mean, the flying was good. It was a lot of camaraderie. You know,
yeah.
I made a lot of good friends there. I had, because the Chinooks were high-value aircraft, they came back to headquarters every night. In other words,
okay.
I wasn't camping out.
Yeah.
I wasn't camping out in the field. I was coming back to base every night, and there was an officers club next door. I lived in an air-conditioned room.
Oh, you had it nice.
Yeah, yeah, it was not bad. Based on that, I decided to go ahead and I hadn't planned on making a career out of the military, so I decided to go ahead and do the additional 6 months in Vietnam to get out early. So the day I came back, I got out of the Army. I had zero stateside duty. And at the time, when you graduated from flight school, it was a three-year commitment. So everybody was going to Vietnam for a year, coming back to the States for a year, typically working as an instructor at Fort Rucker or Fort Walters, and then going back for a second tour in Vietnam.
So you didn't do the second tour, you were just...
I did the second tour in conjunction with the first one.
Yeah.
It turned out to be a perfect deal for me.
Yeah. But once you got back, where did you go? All I know is you worked for PHI, so I don't know if that.
Well, there was
a
period. I got out of the Army in December of 1970. I actually got home on Christmas Eve. Came back. My parents didn't know I was coming.
Oh, that's a good surprise.
I showed up unannounced at my parents' house on Christmas Eve,
Christmas
about 8 o'clock
there.
In the evening.
Yeah.
I set up house there in San Antonio, got an apartment, and I started out doing helicopter cattle herding. There was a little one aircraft operator there in San Antonio. It was called Amigo Helicopters.
Yeah. Okay.
And I went to work for them flying a Bell 47 doing cattle herding and flight instruction.
Yeah.
You know, whatever you could do legally with a helicopter to make money.
Yeah.
Santa Claus deliveries, rides,
that's
flight
what
instruction,
doing. Yeah.
Helicopter, cattle herding.
Yeah.
We were doing that.
Yeah.
There was really no future in that. It was fun for a little while, but I went to work after that as a civilian flight instructor in the Air Force T-41 program. T-41's a 172 with a climb prop. So for about 6 months, I was, this was at Stinson Field there in San Antonio. They had 10 or 12 T-41s there, and it was a contract. It was a civilian contractor. It was called Hallmark Aviation that did initial training for Air Force pilots, got them up through solo. About 20 hours or so, and then they went on into the T-37s.
I guess you'd have so you were supposed to get them to solo, but if they didn't get to solo, then they were out of the.
Yeah, they had to make it through this initial program first. It was kind of a screening program to get them through their initial, see if they could adapt to flying.
Yeah,
had the basic skills.
So how long did you stay there?
About 6 months.
6 months.
And at the time I was there, it was almost 100%. Vietnamese pilots, Vietnamese Air Force pilots that were training.
So then they would go back.
They came to the United States to get their flight training, and they go back and fly whatever aircraft they were assigned
to
when they got
Vietnam.
Back. Oh. Yeah. When the Vietnamese pilots came to the United States, They're in Texas, right? So they said all snakes are poisonous. Just rather than say that's a rattlesnake and this is a copperhead, they just said all snakes are poisonous. Don't touch any snakes. Yeah. Stay away from them. So these T-41s were kept outside at night. We got in the airplane to go fly. We were going to go out and do stalls, and we were up at altitude doing stalls, and about a 2-foot-long garter snake had gotten up into the air vent on the ones.
Oh, no.
And it dropped out in his lap while we were doing stalls. And he would have gone out the window if I had not been in the airplane. He was actually scrambling to go out the window. So I don't know if you ever had a snake drop in your lap out of the vent, but it does get your attention, even though it's a little green garter snake.
I guess they spoke English enough to be able to teach them.
They did. And they were very satisfying to teach, because a teacher to them, whether it's a flight instructor or a grade school teacher, anybody who is a teacher is highly respected. Whatever what you say is the word. I mean, they're very good students because they listen, they want to do well, and they're very appreciative of the opportunity that they're getting. So I enjoyed working with them very much.
Yeah. Yeah. So after that, you said 6 months. So would you...
At that point, I ended up going to work for PHI.
Okay.
I came over here to do an interview, drove over with a friend of mine. We interviewed with PHI. I ended up getting hired. He didn't. They had a 200-pound weight limit. If you weighed over 200 pounds, you had to lose weight before you could get hired there.
Okay. Was he over 200?
He was well over 200. Okay. He ultimately did get hired because he lost the weight. But, Tom Eden was his name. And anyway, long story short, I got hired at PHI in April of 72.
How long had they been around before you?
PHI started in 1946.
Oh, okay. So they've been around for a long time. They've been around. By the time you had gotten there.
They were growing at the time. I got hired as a helicopter pilot, and I was still living in San Antonio. And all the PHI work schedule was 7 days on, 7 days off.
Yeah.
So I continued to live in San Antonio, and I drove back and forth to Morgan City every other week to go to work. And I would drive to Morgan City. Crew change day was Friday. You had to be at the Morgan City heliport at daybreak on Friday morning.
Oh, man. So you...
Typically, I'd drive in the night before.
Yeah, drive.
And then Friday morning, they would put me in an aircraft and fly me out. I was based offshore. The helicopter that I was flying stayed offshore.
Okay.
So we had a mechanic out there. We had a radio operator who did flight plans, flight following, and a pilot.
Okay.
It wasn't a drilling rig. It was an operational platform where the wells had already been drilled and they were producing oil, but there were people... You know, there are probably 30 people living out there.
I mean, now it seems like they usually just go out there, drop off people, and come back.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any aircraft based offshore anymore. I don't think there are, but at the time it was fairly common. The Bell 47, which is what I was flying, our typical flight was 2 minutes long. I mean, you would crank up and fly from the main platform off to a little toadstool platform. Yeah. You'd take one guy over there, you'd shut down, he'd go down and read meters or work on a valve or whatever he was going to do, and then you'd take him to the next one. So you might do 30 or 40 2-minute legs in a day.
Oh, just hopping around.
It was just hopping around. Yeah. Rarely did you fly over to another field or even come into the beach unless you needed to swap out an aircraft or something.
Okay.
So I'd go to work. I'd ride out on Friday morning, and I would stay out at the time it was South Marsh Island 23 was the platform. We'd stay out there the whole week, and on the following Thursday, another helicopter would pick us up and bring us in, and we'd go home.
Okay.
So I did that for a year.
For a year?
Actually worked offshore.
Okay.
Flew that job for a year, and as I got more seniority and was eligible to check out in a turbine-powered helicopter, then I checked out in the Bell 206, and I was no longer based offshore. I was now an onshore pilot. Working out of Morgan City.
Yeah. And those usually just take workers out to the rigs and then come back in?
Yep.
Yeah.
Out and back.
Eventually, didn't you fly the Sabreliner?
Well, yeah. So the way this played out is the owner of PHI, a guy named Bob Suggs, who started the company, was a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel. PHI had an aero commander at the time. He lived in New Orleans, and he used the aero commander to... He wasn't a pilot himself.
Okay.
But a PHI pilot would fly him back and forth from New Orleans to Lafayette 3 or 4 days a week. He'd come over here and run the show and then go home at night. And he'd made up his mind that he wanted a Sabreliner. The Sabreliner was what the generals flew around in back in the day. It was called a T-39.
Okay.
The military had those airplanes, and they did, you know, kind of what the military Gulfstreams do now. They flew around the generals. He made up his mind he wanted a Sabreliner, and he put out the word to the pilot staff that anybody with airplane experience who is willing to move to Lafayette, because that's where the airplane was going to be based, and who wanted to fly a Sabreliner, to raise your hand.
Yeah. So, I'll do that.
Yeah, I had some airplane experience. I only had about 200 hours of multi-engine time in airplanes.
Yeah.
No jet time.
Okay. Yeah, so you're...
I was in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
So I got selected to be one of the Sabreliner pilots, which is what moved, what got me to Lafayette. So I moved over here. They sent me off to flight safety, get type rated in the airplane, along with a couple other guys. And from that point on, I was an airplane pilot.
Yeah.
At PHI.
And so you didn't do that, no helicopter stuff after that?
No helicopter. Well, not initially.
Okay.
For about 2 years, all I did was fly airplanes.
Okay.
But there was no 7 and 7 work schedule like there was in the helicopter world. It was pretty much 24/7, 365.
Oh, whenever they need you. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Which was fine in the beginning because we weren't flying a whole lot, but the flying picked up. He loved the airplane. He liked to go visit Bell Helicopters and Sikorsky and go call on other helicopter operators all around the country, and he used it for family vacations and got to the point where we were flying 100 hours a month.
Oh, my gosh. How many pilots were there initially?
There were really only two.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot of flying.
So we were burning up the skies, which was good. I enjoyed it. But after a while, I began to wish for the 7 and 7 schedule and went to management and said, hey, guys, any chance we can get a better work schedule?
Yeah.
And their answer at the time was, well, we got a lot of people who like to fly this airplane. If you want to go back and fly helicopters, we can make a place for you.
Oh, my gosh.
I said, okay, I'll do it.
Yeah.
Well, and so I made the decision to go back and be a helicopter pilot, and they put me in the training department.
Oh, is that what you wanted?
Yeah, well, it was mutually advantageous. They said, how about if we put you in training, that way we can keep you in reserve as an airplane pilot. If somebody's sick or on vacation, we'll keep you current in the airplane and use you as backup.
Yeah.
So that was perfect.
Yeah.
I went back on 7 and 7. I went into the training department in Lafayette, became a check airman in the Bell 206 and the Bell 212, the S-76 and the Bell 412. I actually had four aircraft I was checking in.
Okay.
And that's how I ended up being a DPE.
Oh, okay. That's just by working at PHI and they...
Well, I had a relationship with the FAA because our principal operations inspector was part of becoming a check airman is you have to ride with the FAA and they observe you giving check rides. And when an opening came up for a DPE, the FAA actually contacted me and said, we're looking for a dual rated DPE, airplanes and helicopters. Are you interested? I said, I guess. I said, well, you're now a DPE.
Okay.
Here's a book of temporary certificates. Go to work.
Yeah.
We know you already know how to do it. We're going to send you off to school when we get an opening.
Oh, okay.
So I started doing check rides primarily at PHI.
Okay.
At the time, when you went through Army Flight School, you did not have an FAA instrument rating when you came out of the military. You had what was called a tactical instrument rating, which allowed you to fly instruments in the Army, but you didn't have a civilian instrument rating. So there were a lot of pilots working at PHI who did not have a helicopter instrument rating.
Okay.
Well,
were y'all doing the training and then?
Yes. And so this, during this same time frame in the mid-70s, mid to late 70s, a lot of the customers that PHI flew for, the oil companies, decided they wanted their pilots to have an instrument rating just because there were a lot of days when you get out over the water and the winds are calm and the seas are flat and it's overcast. There's no horizon. They're having some spatial disorientation accidents. And the aircraft didn't have attitude indicators in. A lot of them, the Bell 47s, even the Bell 206s initially, they were VFR only.
Okay, yeah, that can be
We're
tough.
Talking no GPS, yeah. No attitude indicators. Just this was needle ball and airspeed type flying. But they made the decision that we need to get everybody instrument rated. So PHI started training their own pilots. They rented a couple of 172s, and we were giving them some flight time in the 172s to build up their instrument time. And then we got some instrument-equipped 206s. The 206 was not IFR certified.
Yeah.
But these were VFR aircraft that we did training in, and ultimately we ended up getting their instrument rating. So my point is, initially, most of my DPE work was at PHI doing helicopter instrument ratings for people and ATPs and things like that. One of the requirements of being a DPE is you have to service the general public also.
Yeah. So how'd you end up getting out to?
On my 7 days off, I started doing check rides for the general public. PHI was very good about it.
Yeah.
You know, they would actually, on my days off sometimes, I would come out and use my office at PHI to do check rides. But a lot of the people that were learning to fly were oil field service people, you know, people who ended up were riding on PHI helicopters. Yeah. So it was kind of mutually beneficial for both PHI and myself to be able to use PHI facilities.
What year was this when you became a DPE? Around what year?
1988.
So you were doing check rides and actually working out of this building, right? I mean,
yes.
Or this corner of the airport.
Yes. Where we are right now belonged to PHI maintenance. In other words, the director of maintenance and all his minions and so forth were over here in this building overseeing what was going on in this hangar. Our facilities, the operational training facilities, were over where Metro is now.
Okay.
That was where my office was.
Yeah.
While I was working in the training department. After a few years in the training department, PHI came up with a work schedule for the fixed wing crews because they had a couple of other people
who
ended up leaving PHI and going to the airlines.
Oh, okay, because of the...
Yeah, the airlines were hiring at the time too, so they had a couple of other guys come in who had replaced me and were flying the airplane, but decided, well, we're going to go to American Airlines. We had two of our guys go to American. So they came up with a work schedule. It was a 14-7, but I could live with that.
Yeah.
So at that point, I went back into the airplane part of it. At this point, we had 5 King Air 200s.
Okay.
And a Sabreliner.
That's a pretty big fleet for I guess all the corporate upper management would use the planes, right?
That's part of what it was. But the oil companies that we were providing helicopter service to also wanted fixed wing charter.
Okay.
In fact, there was a period of about 3 years where we were running a daily shuttle from Lafayette to Houston. We were taking off at 7 o'clock in the morning from Lafayette, flying to Sugar Land, turning around and coming back to Lafayette. In other words, we take people over. This was for an oil company. It was a scheduled shuttle for an oil company where we made 2 round trips a day, 5 days a week, over and back in the morning, over and back in the afternoon. And more. Quite often, we had 2 or 3 airplanes doing the same thing.
Wow.
And they'd want to go out to, they'd go to Midland, Texas.
Yeah.
They'd go, got to where our charter business was very good. You know, we had a lot going on. And ultimately, we ended up with airplanes, and we had an airplane in Africa.
Oh, wow.
We bought a Hawker 700, and we put it in Uzbekistan. It was in Tashkent, Uzbekistan.
Okay.
And I flew that airplane, too. So
what did they do over there in Africa? Was it just charter-type flying, transporting?
It was one of our oil company customers
who
had a project going on in Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
It was in a city called Atarau. It's right on the northern edge of the Caspian Sea.
Okay.
Huge oil reserves there.
So they were
at the time. They thought the oil reserves there were bigger than Saudi Arabia.
Oh, really?
So there was a lot of drilling going on, but there was no way to get the oil out.
Yeah,
the Caspian Sea is landlocked; it's not open to the world's oceans.
Oh, okay. So
the only way to get the oil out is by a pipeline over to the Black Sea, which takes you the geography between Atarau and the Black Sea is the country of Georgia, which is mountainous and very hostile.
Okay.
They couldn't build a pipeline because it would get blown up all the time. So they decided to go ahead and develop the oil fields and see what's there. And they wanted an airplane. They wanted a Western airplane flown by a U.S. crew to move people in and out of Atterau, because the only airline service in there was Aeroflot, and they were old
airplanes and not really good pilots.
Exactly. Nobody wanted to ride on them. It was easy to see why.
Yeah.
So Lufthansa, you could get into Tashkent in Uzbekistan on Lufthansa. The people would come in on the airline. We would then take them to Atterau, which was about 1,000 miles away.
Okay.
And we did that, and the airplane was for emergency evacuations too, in case somebody got hurt. Yeah. We would take them to, if somebody really got hurt, typically we would take them to Oslo, Norway.
Okay. That's a trip though.
That's a trip. And our airplane did spot charters too a little bit, but it was very interesting flying over there. This was in 1995. It was only a couple of years after the Soviet Union had broken up.
Okay, yeah.
So we were really the first Americans and the first American airplane that a lot of those people had ever seen. And we had to have we were flying Atterau. The main airport we went to was not an international airport, so they did not speak English, period.
Oh, so it was hard to talk to people.
We had to carry a Russian-speaking interpreter on the jump seat.
Okay.
And all of the Russian, they were off-duty Russian airline pilots.
Yeah.
And they all smoked. If you didn't let them smoke, they wouldn't go.
Oh, really?
And they smoked cigarettes. It was looked like a joint.
Yeah.
And it smelled like it was camel shit. I mean, it was bad. It was bad.
We so were on oxygen.
We were on oxygen most of the time. But they're sitting right on the jump seat smoking. Like I said, if you didn't let them smoke, they wouldn't go.
Yeah. Did they bring vodka?
No, but not that I could see.
Okay.
I'll put it that way. So that was interesting. We were going in and out of an airport where we could not understand what was going on the radio. The Russian interpreters using charts that were in Cyrillic. So it was interesting times.
Yes,
I mean, it was interesting times. There were days when we would go out to the airport, you know, in the winter, and it was minus 25 degrees outside.
Oh, man.
The airplane, there was no hangar space, so the airplane's covered with, you know, six or eight inches of snow.
Yeah.
And you don't want to put Russian de-icing fluid on your airplane. It's so corrosive that it's last choice.
The wing will fall off.
Well, it's highly corrosive. So we would get to the airplane a couple of hours early and sweep it off as best we could.
Yeah.
And then the way we de-iced, and it sounds crazy, but it works, they actually had a jet engine mounted in the back of a pickup truck.
Oh, really?
You'd put your engine covers on,
yeah,
and they would back this truck up to the airplane, and the guy knew how much throttle to give it,
yeah,
and they would blast the airplane off with hot air. And it works great.
It works great.
It's probably not very environmentally friendly,
yeah,
but that's also how they de-ice the runway. They have a big jet engine mounted on the side of a flatbed trailer, an 18-wheeler,
yeah,
that's pointed down at a 45-degree angle with a huge fuel tank on the front of it. They drive down the center of the runway in one direction and blast off half the runway, turn around, come back the other way, and blast off the other half.
Wow.
That's how they de-ice the runway.
Different world up there.
It is a different world.
Yeah.
It was literally like stepping back 50 years,
yeah,
in both, not on the aviation side of it, but in living conditions. It was interesting flying. A lot of the navigation was, GPS was in its infancy back in those,
yeah,
days. I mean, it was really military. We were navigating with VLF, very low frequency. And LORAN, there was some LORAN available.
I've heard of LORAN. I've never heard of
But a lot of ADF, frequency. NDB navigation. In fact, there are a lot of approaches with two NDBs.
Oh, wow.
One of them is at the outer compass locator like we're used to now.
Yeah.
The other one's at the end of the runway. You had two ADFs in the airplane. As long as the needles were pointing at each other, you were on course. If they were off to the right, you know, you got to where you're pretty good at NDB,
yeah,
approaches, which is a lost art now.
Yeah, it is. Yes.
But NDB approaches used to be a thing. I mean, you actually were doing them, and there are still some overseas, not nearly as many as they were. You know, another thing a lot of people don't realize is altimetry is different when you get over to Russia, too.
I remember you've talked about this before because you, when you were flying with NetJets, you went over to Russia a lot.
Yes, it's called QFE altimetry. In simple terms, when you're on the ground, regardless of the elevation of the airport, the altimeter reads zero. So if you're at a 1,500-foot elevation airport, you set the altimeter setting when you're on the ground is zero.
So that's more like absolute altitude than once you get up in the air, huh?
There's an area between roughly 6,000 feet and 8,000 feet where nobody flies. You only transition up through it or down through it. So, you know, here in the United States, the transition level is at 18,000 feet. Over there, it's like 6,000 feet, let's say. So as you take off using QFE, as you go through 6,000 feet, you go to 2,992, and then everything's a flight level.
Okay.
Knowing what I know now, after having a had a chance to do it in an airplane like a Gulfstream and where it's much more user-friendly, it's metric altitudes also.
Oh, okay.
Metric altimetry. And the only altimeter we had was the standby altimeter in the Hawker, whereas, you know, in the Gulfstream, you just punch a button and it switches everything to metric.
Yeah, yeah. different world.
It was a different world.
Yeah. How long did you work at PHI in the fixed-wing department with the King Airs and the...
So starting in about 1982 or so, when I initially went back into the fixed-wing department after doing the training thing at PHI, the rest of my career, I was primarily an airplane pilot, but they kept me current in helicopters so that I could give check rides. Okay. They kept me current as a check airman so I could do primarily ATP rides for PHI pilots.
Yeah. But eventually they got rid of the fixed wing side.
Well, they did.
At some point, and that's, I think, when you moved on, huh?
Yes. Late 2000, PHI was having financial problems. The owner had died. His wife was running the company. Wonderful lady, doing a great job, but business was not as good as it had been before. Long story short, they were going to sell their airplanes in order to raise money to put into the helicopter operation.
Oh, okay.
And at that point, when they decided to sell the airplanes, they offered me two choices, either go back into the helicopter side, or they offered me a buyout. I'd been there 28 years.
Yeah.
And it was a sizable chunk of money.
Yeah.
So I took the money and left.
Okay. I'll take the money. See you.
Well, I never thought I'd leave PHI, you know, and it was a great job. And the timing was such that I had some friends who were at NetJets that had been at PHI, who were flying the Gulfstream there, who were calling me every week saying, you need to come over here. This is
a great place to work.
It's good and getting better.
Yeah.
And so the timing was right. I left PHI and went directly to, I left PHI in January, and I was working full-time at NetJets in May. So I had about 3 months, which is about how long it took to go through the interview process, get a class date and all that.
And what year was this again?
This was in 2001.
Okay.
I went to work for NetJets. I left PHI in January of 2001, went to NetJets in May of 2001.
Did September 11th? Affect y'all at NetJets?
Drastically. NetJets prior to September 11th was all Part 91 operations.
Okay.
91K, which was fractional.
Yeah.
And we did have a 135 certificate. We had one airplane that was on 135 to have the certificate and check the box. After 9/11, the only airplanes that could fly initially were 135.
Oh,
airplanes
really?
That were on. Our whole fleet was grounded for about 2 weeks, I think it was.
Okay.
You know, 10 days to 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Our 135 airplane could fly first. And so NetJets kind of started thinking, you know, we probably need to put everything on 135. That way, if this ever happens again.
Yeah, y'all are covered.
We're covered. So that started the transition into 135.
Okay. Each person that buys into NetJets, they own a share. It's like a timeshare, but with airplanes kind of deal, right?
Yes, it's primarily fractional ownership, although you can buy a card. It's called a marquee card, where you buy a block of time. I think the smallest block they sell is 25 hours. Don't quote me on that, but this is for people who want to try it out. You know, they don't want to commit to a quarter share in an airplane. They want to try it out. or maybe it's for people who really don't have the financial strength to buy into the program, but they have money and they don't want to travel on the airlines, but they don't have the kind of money it takes to buy into a buy a share. Maybe they're newly wealthy people and don't have the big bucks in the bank, shall we say,
to
buy into a program full time.
You went straight into the Gulfstream?
I did. At the time that I hired on, it wasn't called NetJets. It was called Executive Jet Aviation.
Okay.
There were two separate companies. Executive Jet Aviation was the Learjet, Citations, Hawkers. Executive Jet International was the Gulfstream fleet.
Okay.
And it was a separate pilot group. It was a non-union pilot group. Executive Jet Aviation was a unionized company.
Okay.
NetJets International was non-union, separate pilot group, all Gulfstreams.
Okay.
And I hired in an Executive Jet International, started flying the G4 to start out with.
And you stayed there for a while. I mean, just recently you left there, but that was a retirement.
At the time that I hired on, there was no retirement age at NetJets.
So you could be 100 years old.
You could be. As long as you can pass a first-class physical and pass your check rides, then you could continue to work.
Yeah.
About 3 years ago, the omnibus budget bill passed, and there was a little caveat in that bill that said any 135 operator with more than 75,000 takeoffs, departures per year, and that was pretty much only NetJets at the time, although it covered PHI also, can voluntarily request an age 70 retirement rule.
Okay.
By writing a letter to the FAA administrator.
Yeah.
And NetJets had been wanting a retirement age. So they wrote the letter to the administrator in January of 2023. It went into effect a year later.
Okay.
So on January 10th of 2024, the rule went into effect. So everybody at NetJets who was 70 or older was forced to retire on January 10th of this year. And that was me.
Yeah.
I'm 76.
Okay.
So I got an extra 6 years out of the deal.
Yeah. Then you, yeah.
Yeah.
Weren't there some pilots that were older?
Yes.
You still flying?
Believe it or not.
Over there? Yeah.
I think we had a couple of 80-year-old pilots
who
were caught up in it. I understand the reasoning for it, because especially for those of us who are in the long-range airplanes, because a KO enforces an age 65 rule, which means that pilots who are over 65 cannot go to Europe.
So over here, it's only the airlines that require you to retire at 65.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. A Part 91 pilot can go to Europe.
Okay.
But if you're flying for hire, and 135 is obviously for hire, they consider that the same as they do the airline. So all the NetJets pilots who are 65 or older, there are a lot of places we couldn't go, which is a big scheduling nightmare if you're in one of the long-range airplanes.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, a fairly high percentage of the older pilots were out on sick leave.
So you said the G4, right, was the first plane?
The G4. And everything was based on seniority, even though we were not unionized at the time. It was all still based on seniority. So you started out as an FO in the G4.
Yeah.
Then after you got some seniority, you upgraded to captain in the G4. Then you would upgrade to captain in the G5. The G5 type rating covers three different Gulfstreams. It covers the 5, the 450, and the 550. So once you made the jump into the G5 type rating, you were flying those three airplanes, the 450, the 550, and the 5. We had all three airplanes in the fleet. The G4s initially were phased out completely, where it was just the G5 models that were in the fleet.
And now, the NetJets eventually started getting rid of the Gulfstream, right? Aren't they?
They did. They decided that their long-range airplane was going to be the Global Express.
Okay. So now that's what they have now.
Yes, the Gulfstreams have all been phased out now, and we have the—
Because I remember you talking about how you were going to—we weren't sure what plane you were going to go in because they were getting rid of the Gulfstreams and—
Yeah. All of the Gulfstream pilots got displaced, which is the company gets to pick which airplane they put you in.
Yeah. Okay.
And all the Gulfstream pilots got displaced to the Phenom, which is the smallest airplane in the fleet.
Oh, okay.
But at Gulfstream pay. Oh, the way the NetJets pay scale works is if you're flying an airplane that's over 40,000 pounds max gross weight, there are only three airplanes in the fleet at the time that qualified: the Gulfstream, the Global, and the Challenger, you know, the 605 Challengers. Yeah. So if you're in one of those three airplanes, you were in a higher pay scale. But so when the Gulfstreams went away, they displaced all the Gulfstream pilots to the Phenom at Gulfstream pay. Now, you didn't have to stay there. If you didn't want to fly the Phenom, you could bid out into any of the airplanes in the fleet. But if you bid out of the Phenom into an airplane that wasn't in the 40,000 pound or higher weight category, you got a pay cut. And some people did that.
Yeah.
Some people said, well, I want to stay in the long range airplane. So they bid into the Global.
Yeah.
After they phased out the Gulfstreams, I never type rated in a different airplane, because I think I called in the 23 years that I was there, I maybe called in sick once.
Oh, really? So you had a lot of sick time.
I had so much sick leave on the books. Yeah. And the way it worked at the time, if you did not use that sick leave, you lost it. They would pay you for your vacation that you had accrued. But if you left the company, that sick leave that was in your long-term sick leave bank, you lost it. It was over 100 calendar days that I had, because each day really counted for 2 days if you think about the fact you work 7 and 7.
Yeah.
So when I had all that sick leave and I realized I was going to get caught by the age 70 rule, I said, I'm just going to burn this sick leave.
I'm going to be sick for a long time.
I'm going to burn my sick leave, which is what I did. So yeah. I never type rated in a different airplane. Okay. So when I left, I actually went back on full. I was not on sick leave in January when I left. I had gone back on full-time duty. I went back on full-time duty about 4 months before I was going to have to leave. But for them to spend the money to type rate me in the airplane, check me out in the airplane, it was cheaper just to pay me to sit at home.
Yeah.
Perfect job for me. I loved it. It was the schedule was such. I knew my schedule a year in advance,
which
allowed me
nice.
To do the DPE stuff without having to make last-minute changes.
Yeah. You know?
Got to see the world.
Yeah, you went all, in the Gulfstream, you were, I mean, I talked about Russia, but I mean, I'm sure you went every country in
the
world.
We did. We went everywhere. I mean, you were kind of spring-loaded to go anywhere in the world at any time. I mean, my first day at work at NetJets was an airline flight from Lafayette to wherever the airplane I was going to cover was going to be. And I've gone to Tahiti, to Hong Kong, to Vietnam, to London, any place that you can think of. I mean, I've airlined there to meet my airplane, and you fly it for a week. Wherever you end up on the last day, they airline you home.
Yeah, that's a nice deal there, too.
So there are times when you airline to the Far East, let's say, and you don't see the U.S. your entire week. I mean, because you're over there flying
just
in that part of the world,
and
then you end up popping on the airlines to come home. So it's an adventure, to say the least. It's a big adventure.
Sounds like an adventure. And now you're still just doing DPE stuff, right?
I have been doing some contract flying. There was a Gulfstream 450 here in Lafayette that just got sold. In fact, it left this week.
Oh, really?
And I've been doing a little bit of flying on it.
Yeah.
But other than that, and flying my own airplanes, is strictly just the DPE stuff. Yeah. And the DPE thing's been great. It's not only is it it's a nice little side income, but you meet a lot of people doing this, and it's opened a lot of doors for me.
Yeah.
I've done quite a few things I would not have gotten to do otherwise through being a DPE. Just as an example, I don't know if you remember David Johnson or not, but David made a lot of money in the oil field. He sold his service company, made 30-some-odd million dollars overnight. He'd always wanted to have an airplane collection. Well, I met him doing his private pilot check ride. He said, would you like to see a picture of the airplane I just bought? I said, sure. Showed me a picture of a P-51 TF.
Wow.
which is a dual-control P-51.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, I told him, I said, David, you know, you can't go from a 172 to a P-51.
Yeah, no,
he said,
yeah.
Oh, so I know. I've also got a Stearman, a T-6, and a T-28
coming. I'm going to work my way up, too.
And I've hired a full-time moorboard instructor to teach me. And sure enough, he did all of that.
Wow.
And so through my association with him, I got to fly the P-51 a little bit, and I got to fly a DC-3, got type rated in a DC-3 bought, and became a member of that little flying club, a group of about 20 or so local pilots who got to fly that batch of airplanes that he bought. That's just an example of how I met him through being a DPE, and it resulted in lots of fun things.
Yeah, you get to meet a lot of people. I mean, just to be, as an instructor, you know, you get to meet a whole bunch of people. You have a lot of ratings.
Well, I've always enjoyed getting ratings, you know, the training that goes with it and the people that you meet doing it. And so I've always pursued different things when they're available. And I found that even things that you don't think are going to make a difference make you a better pilot overall, you know.
Yeah.
A glider rating, as an example,
yeah,
makes you pretty good at simulated engine failures
in
airplanes.
Yeah, you talk about that all the time.
So I've always enjoyed doing that and never passed up an opportunity to get checked out in something new.
Where did you do the glider training at?
I initially did it in San Marcos, over by San Antonio.
Okay, yeah, I know where that's at.
When I got out, when I graduated from Army Flight School, I had 30 days between the time I finished flight training and the time I had to go to Vietnam. So I went back to San Antonio, and a buddy of mine who I'd gone through flight school with was there, and they were doing glider training in San Marcos. So he said, let's go get our glider ratings. And we did it. It only took 2 days.
Oh, really? Yeah, that sounds fun because, I mean, so did they tow you up?
Yeah, they tow you up.
Okay.
They tow you up behind another airplane, and they cut you loose in the traffic pattern. You do that till you get the landing part figured out, and then they take you up to altitude, and they show you how to thermal and how to, you know, simulated rope brakes, things like that.
Okay.
And they also towed you up behind a car.
Did they?
An auto tow, they
really?
Call it. Yes. So we did that. We got the ratings. And then about 10 years later, I decided I wanted my glider CFI. So I went out to Arizona, to Phoenix, to do that.
Okay. Do you use any of that? Do you go fly gliders?
Nope.
No?
I would if I had the opportunity, but
yeah,
there's not much glider flying going on around here.
Yeah, no.
You know, the thermals that you use, the thermals stop when you get to the cloud bases,
yeah,
typically. And the clouds are hardly ever higher than about 7,000 feet around here, cloud bases, when
yeah,
we have clouds. So there's not a lot of opportunity to get a lot of altitude. I mean, okay, when you get out west, places like that.
Well, you got the mountains
you
probably
got mountains
pushing you
and
up.
That's
too,
right.
Yeah.
You can get more lift, and, you know, it's easier to fly gliders when you got that kind of lift. It's great fun. There's something magical about being in an airplane that's climbing with no motor in it.
Yeah,
you know? And it's quiet, too.
That's the
freaky. No vibration, very little noise. It's fun.
I guess that's pretty much it.
Well, I enjoyed talking with you.
Yeah,
and thanks
for
inviting me over.
Yeah,
and
we're glad you came. And hearing all about your life. And I'd also like to do one where maybe we talk about FAA, DPE type stuff, too.
Yeah, we can do that, too. I'd be happy to, you know, to
give people
we could talk
tips
about common weak areas I see on people coming in for check rides, because that's no secret. You know, we try to overcome those common weak areas that.
Yeah, that would be a good one to do. That would be we could do a part A and a part B.
It's hard to know what to study for because there's so much information to be responsible for. And I always tell people if it took as much to get a driver's license as it does to get a pilot's license, to be a different world.
Yeah, it would be. Some people wouldn't be driving.
But having said that, you know, you're not expected to know everything. Nobody does. It's a matter of being able to access the reference material if you don't know the answer. If you don't know the answer, know how to find the answer without Googling it. Know how to go to the FAR AIM or the Airplane Flying Handbook or whatever the reference material is.
FAA material.
Yeah, the FAA material. If you know how to do that, then chances are you're going to be fine on the knowledge part of it.
Hey, tomato flames. Hey, tomato flames. People use that one all the time, and it's so long, you're trying to figure out, well, see, like, the T could be attack, the T, you know. So if you just remember 91205, it's a lot easier because it's a smaller amount, and you can look it up, and then you find the answer.
Yeah, in my bag, I've got about a four-page list of acronyms a guy gave me who was studying for his CFI check ride, and he's got acronyms for everything.
Yeah.
You know, RUAC as an example.
Yeah, I've heard that one recently.
Road
too.
Understanding, application correlation. I mean, there's all kinds of acronyms that people use that help them memorize things.
Yeah. See, and I don't know that many because I know Aviate and I know Aero and I remember Ada Tomato Flames, but I don't ever remember what letters go with.
Oh, I've got this whole pages of them. I'll show them to you.
Okay.
You know, it's funny.
Yeah.
If it's,
and I feel like there's new ones coming all the time.
Oh, yeah. There's, some of them are hilarious.
Yeah. Well, I just like the WAG method, you know. Don't be
WAG.
Using the WAG method. It stands for wild ass guess.
WAG.
WAG method.
Sometimes it works.
Flight Tales. Woo-hoo. If you made it this far, you listened to the entire episode.
And for that, we would just like to say thank you, and we hope you enjoyed it. We would also like to thank Peyton for coming on the show and sharing his story. If you have any questions about today's episode or suggestions for future episodes, just leave a comment or message us, and we'll do our best to answer. If you'd like to check out some fun aviation videos, subscribe to our YouTube channel at Owens Flight Training. Or if you'd like to get more information on becoming a safe, knowledgeable, and confident pilot, just head over to our website, owensflighttraining.com. Flight!